Welcome back to Not Too Busy to Write. I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach. Today I'm speaking with Charlotte Wood. Charlotte is an Australian author of 10 books. Her 2016 novel, The Natural Way of Things, won the Stella Prize, amongst many other prizes, and her 2020 novel, The Weekend, became an international bestseller. Her latest novel, which is out now, Stoneyard Devotional, tells the story of a woman who abandons her life in the city, her marriage, and her career to retreat to a religious community in an isolated region of Australia. It's a story about forgiveness, about lost hope, and about grief. Charlotte and I talk about the evolution of her craft as a writer and her deliberate decision she made to not over-explain anything in this novel to the reader. We also talk about what life is like for a writer after receiving lots of accolades, and also her favourite underread Australian writers. Charlotte also has a fantastic Substack called Subtraction, which looks deeply at the creative process. I will put links to that and also all the books mentioned in the episode in the show notes. Don't forget that Not Too Busy to Write is also now on Substack, and the link to that is also in the show notes. Enjoy the episode. Hi, Charlotte. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Hi, Penny. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to dive straight into Stoneyard Devotional. It's a book about a woman who retreats from life and goes to live in quite an isolated religious community. And I wanted to start there with that setting and what drew you particularly to that setting. I wondered if perhaps it was either a curiosity about why someone would abandon everything, or is it almost perhaps a little bit of part of you that fantasizes about doing something similar?
Look, I think there is a part of me that loves the idea of sort of completely withdrawing from the world. And especially now, you know, with, you know, the news cycle, it's so overwhelming with this sort of onslaught of the world's cruelties and horrors and tragedies. And you know, my character has sort of, as you said, dropped out of her life, in just abandoned her job and her marriage and goes to this religious community despite not having any religious belief herself, but she escapes there, I guess. And it is in this quite barren part of the world in Australia, in New South Wales, an area called the Monero Plains, and it's actually where I grew up, and the narrator also grew up there. And I guess, I mean, I've never written about that place before, and this is my 10th book, and I was sort of didn't really know why I was drawn to that, except after the fact I realised that the very sort of stripped back nature of the landscape mirrors her own sort of psychic desolation, I suppose. Mm-hmm. That she almost goes there out of a sort of animal instinct, and I think at some point kind of or subconsciously realizes that it's the landscape that will understand her present state of mind.
And I wanted to ask you about that location. I actually wasn't that familiar with it, and I went and looked up. So it's in down in New South Wales, down towards the border of Victoria, is it? And I've been able to watch some of it on footage on your website, which I will put a link to for people to go see. It's incredible, I think, to be able to see that landscape. So this is the first time you've written about that area that you grew up.
Yes, it is. And it's sort of, I don't know if it's something to do with enough distance from my time there. I haven't really been there very much at all since my parents died when I was in my 20s. I'm now the age my mother was when she died. So it's, and the narrator in the book, that relationship with her and her mother is very much my relationship with my mother, you know, kind of skewed kind of way, because I have four siblings who are completely absent in the book. So it's a sort of, I guess, a slant portrait of my mother. Mm. And then, of course, there's all the completely invented material of the novel, which is about the religious community and the nuns and the rest of it.
In the novel, there's a big focus on this idea of forgiveness. And, you know, who deserves it? Who gets to give it? Who gets to receive it? Who's willing to receive, like to give it as well? And it really struck me that actually this was something that
came up in The Weekend as well, your previous novel, this idea of forgiveness. And I wonder, do you think as writers, it's sort of, we have these things that we almost can't help but continually sort of pick up and turn over in a way, in different kinds of ways and in different narratives?
I think that's true, but without sort of understanding it at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, so it's this, and I think that's good, that that you're kind of, you know, what I think Jonathan Franzen has called your hot material. It will out, you know, no matter what you're writing about, that your unconscious, subconscious preoccupations will always sort of rise to the surface in your work. And I think that's a good thing, because to me, that's what art is about, is accessing that unconscious, you know, our sort of dream self in a way. So, and, you know, you're the first person to say that actually about The Weekend and this book, about the forgiveness angle. And I had not thought about myself. So, but you're right, because those friends in The Weekend have, you know, they're sort of trespasses against each other, and forgiveness is that they have to bring to those in small moments and then some very large moments. So, yeah, no, that's amazing. I hadn't thought of it.
It's interesting, because I read them really reasonably close together. So maybe that's why it really struck me. But they are, on the surface, very different books. And I wanted to talk to you about actually the unexplained in Stoneyard Devotional, what goes unsaid, because so much goes unsaid. So much of the narrator's life is sort of, you know, chunks of it are missing to the reader. And I wanted to talk to you about that. This is your seventh novel and your 10th book. And to me, my feeling is, when I read it, is just the craft, the level of craft necessary to be able to do what you do in Stoneyard Devotional with not explaining everything is really incredible. And I'd love to talk to you about that evolution that you've been on as a writer, to go from perhaps explaining more to getting to this point where you don't explain very much, but I never feel lost. I always feel engaged.
Thank you so much for saying that. It is a bit of a risk, you know, as a writer, to decide, and it was a decision, that I am not going to explain everything. And it's sort of, and I think it has taken me this long to get the confidence to take that risk, because whenever you take that risk, you are risking that a reader will feel lost or confused or whatever. But I guess by now I know that, as a reader myself, that's what I love. I love having to do some work. You know, I love a sense of spaciousness and a place for my own subconscious, my own experience to enter another person's book. That's me as a reader. So as a writer, I was really sort of committed this time to sort of taking that as far as I could, really, in this book. And you're right, it is a very different book from The Weekend. It's a much more, I guess, somber sort of tone. It's a quieter book. And I really like that about this book. And it's taken me a long time to, I think in the end, Penny, it's about trusting one's instincts, you know, one's creative impulses, and trusting that. And that's something that I've certainly developed with time, is the more I trust my artistic unconscious impulses, the better.
Yeah.
And I think for a long time, as a beginner writer, and even going along in my mid-career, I have felt, well, I want that there, but it doesn't make sense, and it doesn't, you know, a reader might say, well, why would she put that scene with making a bed right there and then not say anything about it? And then, you know, whereas now I just think, no, I trust it. I trust that impulse. Mm-hmm. So I just put it there. There's something about, you know, the desire to put a scene or, a fragment, an image there. There's something I mean, I'm sort of gesturing at my solar plexus in my gut. There's something kind of almost bodily about that impulse that I now don't question so much.
Yeah.
There are
so many almost still moments and images throughout the book that that are not necessarily explained exactly why they're there, but kind of all together create a mood and an understanding of our narrator, you know, this person who's taking us on this journey. Really small little things that just completely stuck with me, just like the idea of, you know, when the statue of the Mary that gets broken when the room is being cleaned for the visitor that's coming, and that she comes back into her room and she's looking at it and Mary's head is right by her feet. And just there's so many little images that that build up throughout the novel to create a whole picture in a way.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I really liked doing that. And I really enjoyed the kind of fragmented form of this book, which is kind of, you know, the word devotional as a noun means a sort of a day book or a journal, you know, in the Christian sense, offering for the spiritual readings or observations for each day. So my narrator's devotional is her private sort of journal. But that allowed me to just take those fragments of images and just place them there and then have, you know, a bit of a scene of some, you know, an interaction with the other nuns or, you know, the mouse plague that comes into the book. So they're sort of, but those, I quite enjoyed having those moments of stillness of just sort of pure observation, just leaving it there. And I guess it reflects the life of someone in that place, that there is a lot of stillness. There is a lot of reflection and contemplation. I mean, that's the whole point of being there. So, you know, in another book, it perhaps wouldn't work as well.
Yeah.
But just going back to what you said earlier about the kind of evolution of my craft or whatever, I know that I couldn't have done this in my early books because maybe I didn't have that mastery of how to control a narrative still, even though there's a lot of stillness and I hope there's still a kind of narrative drive and tension. But also there's something about voice, I think, as writers that we don't, it's hard to articulate. But I remember seeing a review of a Vivian Gornick book. I don't know if you know Vivian Gornick, an American nonfiction writer and memoirist. And this review said, with Vivian Gornick's work, the voice doesn't tell the story, it is the story. And I love that sense that the voice actually performs a huge amount of the work of it's not just narration, but it's something about tone and even narrative movement, character, you know, so much of it is actually in the voice. And I think, again, I've learned to trust when the voice is right and when it's wrong, just get out, you know, so I can sort of more easily diagnose when it's, you know, losing its, when it's getting a false note or something.
Mm. And I wanted to ask about voice actually because it has such a strong and distinctive voice. And did you find that voice first? Was that one of the first things that came to you? Did you know right from the beginning that she was your narrator? It had to be first person. Was that very clear early on or was that something you had to discover as you went along?
I think it was quite clear. Usually, with each book, I tend to have a sort of little technical challenge for myself, you know, trying something that I haven't done before. Actually, my first book 1,000 years ago was written in the first person. That's long out of print. And after that, I think I was sort of got a bit embarrassed or something about the first person because, you know, people always assume that it's, if it's in first person, it's about you. And I don't think I really understood that when I was writing my first novel. And then I kind of ran away from that. And I think I felt that first person was a kind of, I don't know, babyish form or something, which of course is ridiculous. So I wanted to go back to first person and try and see what happened with it. And also because actually this is a very personal book for me, you know, given the relationship with the mother and so on. So, I mean, I sort of, when friends would ask me as I was working, you know, what are you writing about? And I would sort of, my writing friends, this is, I don't normally talk about it with other people, but I'd say, well, oh, it's kind of about me, but as if I'm a nun, you know, and like, weird. But so I guess the voice is quite close to a version of my own voice. And I enjoyed, I mean, there are technical challenges, as you know, with the first person present tense, particularly, it can be very claustrophobic. You only have one point of view, so you have to be, you know, kind of try and be a bit smart about how to reveal things that, you know, the narrator can't necessarily know, or, you know, so it's, I think to control a first person present tense narrative, I think mine actually goes in and out of past and present tense, but yeah, it's harder than I think, well, certainly harder than I knew when I wrote my first book, for example, and that book was probably rather claustrophobic. And hence it's not been in print for some time.
Well, you mentioned the mouse plague. I really wanted to ask you about the mouse plague because it is, it's such a kind of horrific part of the book in many ways. And the horror of the kind of imagery as well. But one of the things that really fascinated me with that part of the story was how quickly they all adjusted to the horrors of a plague. That to me stood out more than anything. It did remind me quite a bit of that experience of COVID, of how quickly we adjust to quite horrible conditions. What drove you to add that plague into the narrative?
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, I think putting a mouse plague in a book is also quite a risk. There are certain people who just go, I can't even go there. There's something very, very primitive about our response to mice, I think, or rodents, I suppose. Mm-hmm. There's something, you know, almost medieval in the idea of a mouse plague or, you know, bat plague, God forbid. But in Australia, we have had some terrible mouse plagues in the last few years. So we had COVID during the pandemic. There was a shocking mouse plague happening in the west of the state that I live in. And a friend of mine who lives on a farm was telling me about her experiences I am the sort of quintessential jump on a chair screaming if I see a mouse kind of woman. But I went to visit my friend for a couple of days, obviously when we were out of lockdown, during this plague, because there was a TV thing being filmed that they wanted to film it there, that I was interviewed for. And I went there on the absolute promise that the mice could not get into the room that I was sleeping in, and because I just could not have dealt with that at all. But I was astonished at how quickly I became, you know, not horrified by a mouse running across the room. I mean, there's just my friend had one run up her leg one day when she was reading, which I just, again, the fear of that just fills me with utter disgust and horror. But, you know, I was emptying mouse traps every 15 minutes. It was shocking, the kind of just the volume. And you can't maintain the kind of screechy outrage. You just couldn't. You'd be screeching all day long and all night long. So, yeah. But the reason I actually put the mouse plague in the book at the start was that my friend told me a story of waking in the night hearing her piano being played.
Yeah.
And of course it was the mice nesting inside the piano. But once I heard, there was something so chilling about that image, that idea that you wake in the night to a noise of a piano playing itself. that I just kind of thought, I just can't leave that lying there, that fact. I need to put it into it.
It's just too good.
It's too good. And then once I introduced that, then I was like, okay, so it looks like I have a mouse plague in the book. And then it actually became very useful to me, you know, narratively and thematically, in terms of, as you say, these women who's you know, their ethos in the world is to do no harm. They don't eat meat. They don't kill, you know, they wouldn't kill a spider. But they are forced to really quite brutally dispose of these mice because they have to, because, you know, the mice in these circumstances do actually eat everything. They eat concrete. They eat the electrical wires. You know, people, my friend, when I saw her oven hadn't worked for months because the wires had been eaten and there was no point in replacing it until the plague was over. So it was quite shocking, but it also allowed me to bring into the book the kind of notion that, you know, you can leave the world, but the world won't necessarily leave you. You know, it comes in whether you like it or not, and it's, you know, to be honest, I really never resolved while I was writing it the meaning, in inverted commas, of the plague. But it's been really lovely for me to see what readers are bringing to that, what meaning they're making of that. And for some people, it's a kind of environmental statement, because these plagues and things do happen when, you know, the seasons are out of balance. I mean, in Australia, we are living absolutely in the very brutal effects of climate change all the time. We have, you know, rolling fires, then floods. We had the pandemic, you know, and it feels very biblical, you know, plagues and, you know, great destructive forces of nature just kind of rolling repeatedly through our lives. And it's and you know, my narrator had sort of lost faith in her work as an environmentalist, and that's really a sort of crisis of a kind of psychic collapse, I suppose, for her in terms of her work, which was more than her work. It was her sort of whole self put into this existence. And I guess, you know, the plague is also another sign of that collapse of the kind of peaceful natural order of things.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And so I wanted to pick up on something you wrote in another book of yours. You have a nonfiction book called The Writer's Room, which I've just listened to on audio, which is a fantastic way to read it for anyone, especially here in the UK, where you can just quickly download it. It's brilliant. It's so nice to hear it read out loud. I know these were conversations.
It's great, actually. I love that audio book because they did the male and female
different actors. It's really fantastic. And it feels absolutely right to kind of be consuming that, I guess is the word, on audio as well. But there was something that you mentioned in your introduction to Tegan Bennett Daylight. And the interview with her, you talk about her writing. You get that feeling of, you don't know, you're torn between wanting to kind of keep reading, sit down and keep reading, and then running off to write. And I loved that because I had just, when I listened to it, I just finished Stone Yard Devotional, and I had that exact same feeling with Stone Yard Devotional, exact same. And I was thinking about that a lot, about what is it about certain books that make me want to run off and write. And I was thinking, I think perhaps it's to do with understanding that there is something going on a craft level, like on a line level, that that is exciting, and that is exciting, that kind of creative process that's that kind of beyond narrative, beyond getting kind of swept away with the story.
Yes, oh, I'm so happy you felt that. Thank you. I love that feeling when I read. And lately I absolutely get it from Elizabeth Strout, Sigrid Nunez, Deborah Levy, writers like that. And I really have that sense of it is a tension between wanting to stay with the work and just, and I think the effect of when it happens, it just opens up my brain in some way that material just floods in. Mm. And a lot of the time when I'm writing, I find I find it very difficult, and it's, you know, often sort of blood from a stone, you know, really. It's sort of squeezing out bits of, inspiration, I guess. Whereas when that happens, it just pours. It's not that the writing itself necessarily pours, but the ideas pour and the kind of sensations. And it's almost as if, you know, you look up, Joan Silber is another writer I love, the American. And I remember I actually ended up writing a blurb for one of her books in Australia. And I said that kind of the same effect was that when I look up from her work, I see the whole, everything I see is alive and with kind of bristling with meaning and potential and sort of it's available to me as a writer. Whereas with another writer, I'd look at the world and see just ordinariness, nothing sort of, I don't know, nothing exciting for me to absorb. So I think, you know, I know that some writers say they don't read fiction while they're writing fiction or something, but I just cannot imagine that because to me it's like, it's the oxygen for the work that I'm doing is to read other writers. So thank God they're there.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? The thing about when people say they don't read when they're writing, I'm like, well, I'm writing quite a lot of the time. Like, when would I get to read if I didn't write at the same time as I was reading?
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, I've always said it's like a runner saying I don't breathe while I'm running, you know.
I wanted to ask you something else that came up quite a bit in the writer's room. Quite a lot of writers brought up this idea of walking and writing. And I wondered if you were a walker as well, because I'm a walker. I so much get sorted out in my head, either consciously or unconsciously when I'm walking. And I wanted to know if you have that similar experience as well.
I do. And I do have that experience, and I still don't walk enough. I do walk, you know, all the time, but for some reason I always think, oh, I better go for a walk. You know, I sort of feel that it's an obligation or something. But then as soon as I'm out the door, you know, there's something about the attention that you have to pay to, you know, the pavement and crossing the road and or the trees or whatever, that allows your unconscious mind to sort of loosen up and free itself from, you know, the sort of grasping that sometimes happens when I'm working on it, particularly if it's something a bit troublesome, you know, technically or whatever, or even just, you know, making those connections that have to be made in the course of writing a novel. Often, very often, it's on a walk where, the connection will come. On a walk or in the shower or driving sometimes. If I had to drive, you know, quite a way, something just for an hour or something, that will often loosen the knot.
Yeah, absolutely. Driving is another one for me. I used to have to drive quite a lot for work. Back when I was a photographer, I would drive across the country for shoots and things. And it was great actually in the beginning when I started writing, because I would put on some music instead of listening to an audiobook, which I'm a bit of an audiobook theme, so it's very easy to always listen to one, and driving across the country with music, and it's just amazing things can happen with writing when you're able to have that space.
Yes, and I think something about driving across the country rather than, you know, around the city or something.
Yeah,
it's the sort of openness of the space around you. I also think the natural world in any form, being in it or near it, really does something for the creative mind. I don't know why, but I believe that, and I think there is actually research about that, you know, that, you know, if you are in a sort of beautiful natural setting, given, you know, that you're also working hard and, you know, have a kind of presence to the work, that connections do come more easily than not.
This is your seventh novel and your 10th book, and I wanted to ask about how things have changed over that time. You're a book, The Natural Way of Things, won the Stella Prize in 2016. And that was your, was that your fourth novel? That one your third or your fourth?
That was my fifth.
Fifth. And and then after that, The Weeknd went on to be a huge international bestseller. And I wanted to talk to you about what that has changed for you in terms of your experience of being a writer, both positive and negative, if there are both, from that first part of your career and then this sort of next phase of your career where you're, you know, a lot more well-known.
Thanks, Penny. That's a good question. And there are definitely positives and negatives, more positives, thank goodness for me. But the first thing is time. Oh, actually, this is a paradoxical thing because I can write full time now, and that is the greatest luxury on earth. And, you know, before The Natural Way of Things, I wrote as part of a PhD in Australia, which is, you know, I confess, basically a way of getting funding to, you know, write a book because you have a scholarship or whatever. And before that, I had always worked part-time, sometimes full-time, while I was writing books. And, you know, everyone who writes knows how it is a struggle to just find time. It's, I don't have kids, and I still found it a struggle. So I'm sort of in awe of writers who have children and jobs as well as writing. So the time opening up in that way is really just such a privilege. At the same time, your time shrinks in other ways because you're asked to do a lot more things. There's a lot more promotion. There's more travel. There's more people ask you to do things, you know, to blurb their books and, you know, interview them. There's just a lot more asked of you in the kind of literary community sense as well as in the sort of publicity and media sense. And, of course, all of those things are desirable, but they, I guess they could take up a lot of time. But there's another thing that actually interviewing Christos Tsolkas in the Writer's Room book. So I interviewed him before, while I was writing The Natural Way of Things, actually. Mm-hmm. So I've been sort of poodling along at a kind of, you know, perfectly reasonable level of success in inverted commas, but nothing particularly outstanding. And I asked Christos this question after the slap, which was, you know, it's very big international hit. I don't know if you know it, but it was a big book. And, you know, television series and all kinds of things came out of that. And I asked him this question of what were the things that you didn't expect out of that success that were maybe difficult for you. And he said something completely fascinating, which was, he said, I didn't expect how greedy it makes you. Mm. Meaning that once you, I was so glad I talked to him before anything sort of took off for me, because I really had never forgotten that. He said, once you get a certain level of success, you just want more, you know, and you feel that you deserve more, and you, it's sort of, you assume that you're going to get more, and that is not necessarily the case. And I mean, Christos is an extremely modest and generous person, so I can't actually imagine him being horrendously greedy, but I certainly understand the feeling and the need to just eradicate that impulse in yourself, you know. So it was great to have that in my head, you know, when my books, I mean, they've never done as well as a slap, but, you know, that had a, to me, surprising level of success. Mm-hmm. And it was just a very good thing to be aware of.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, you know, that just this week that we're having this conversation, the Women's Prize long list was announced. And there are, I think on that long list, at least half debuts, which is, you know, fantastic. But it does make me wonder, what is that like for a debut to get long listed for a major prize? And then do you have that feeling of like, well, am I still successful if my next book doesn't get long listed?
Yeah. Look, I think success, like sort of, especially somewhat like, you know, Eleanor Catton or whatever, who I think was her first or second book that won the book. I mean, yeah. I don't know how people deal with that level of success. And I always put the word in, you know, inverted commas.
Acclaim maybe is a good word.
Yes, acclaim. That's a good, because, you know, what looks to be amazing and wonderful on the outside can be very destabilizing and scary for some people. And obviously it's great to make a lot of money from books because it means you can write more books. But, you know, the pressure, I was just so glad that I was quite a lot older than lots of people when my first, success happened. I'd been steadily, you know.
Yeah.
I was sort of very happy with my level of profile or whatever, because I could keep writing, you know, I could keep publishing. That's really, I feel like that's all any writer really wants. But I've also heard just appalling stories of, you know, people who had early acclaim and then sort of going to tantrum throwing when it doesn't happen with the next book, or judge themselves incredibly harshly or think they're a terrible failure, or, you know, and it's just all of that stuff about, you know, public acclaim for your work is just a waste of energy and a waste of time. And, you know, I think one thing about getting older is, you know, I don't have that time to muck around, to waste on all these external things you have absolutely no control over.
Yeah.
All you can control is your attention to your work. And that's, you know, I always say to younger writers, just go back to work. Just work. Don't think about all that stuff, because you have no way of, you might be able to influence certain aspects of it, but really once the book is out in the world, it really has nothing to do with you anymore. You know, and you certainly can't follow it around trying to make sure that people receive it in the right way or it gets to the right people or any of that. You just got to let go. And I would always say to younger writers, once your book is out, start another one straight away.
Yeah.
So you don't sort of fixate on what happens to your book in the world, because you can't.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think it's so true, this idea of, you know, we need our books to do well enough so we can keep working. You know, and we need to, you know, in hopefully in an ideal world, we might make a living. Right.
Yeah.
It'd be ideal.
And that's hard. I mean, you know,
it's hard
to make a living. And, you know, I feel like I'm making, you know, a reasonable living, but it's not, you know, there's no riches in the writing life, really. So I feel that making a living is astonishing good luck, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to ask you about what Australian fiction you would recommend. We don't, this podcast is everywhere, but our the listeners, I think it's probably around 70% British and Irish. Hello, Australian listeners. I know you're out there. But I am constantly astonished that I really struggle to get Australian fiction over here, and I tend to buy it when I go back home. But I would love to hear some of your recommendations of what you would love to, what Australian writers you'd love to see read a bit more widely internationally by other English speaking.
Oh, lovely. Thank you. It is so hard to get Australian fiction published here in the UK and America. I mean, it's sort of, you know, well, you know how far away we are in Australia from kind of centres of the world. So it's difficult. But so some books that I absolutely adore by Australian writers. There's a writer, and, you know, these are not new books generally. Probably my favourite Australian writer is Joan London. I don't know if you know who it is. She hasn't published for a while, but her last book was called The Golden Age. My favourite of hers is called The Good Parents. She is one of those writers that as soon as I read a sentence of hers, I want to run away and write. But I can't, because I'm also just riveted by her prose. Just a beautiful, very subtle stylist, but with a great depth, you know, this sort of river of meaning underneath everything. So Joan London. Amanda Laurie is another wonderful writer. And I interviewed both of those writers in the writer's room. Amanda has a new book out, and the conversion, it's called, about a woman who buys an abandoned church and renovates it or converts it. But as she's doing so, it starts to think maybe this is sort of somehow wrong, you know, this consecrated space to. Anyway, she's just a superb intellectual, really, and a beautiful writer. Other writers, well, Christos Tsokas is very, he also has a new book out called The In-Between, and he's coming to the UK in a couple of weeks, actually. And Christos is in nothing like those writers that I mentioned before, but he's so challenging and kind of fearless in his, he writes a lot about, so the new book, The In-Between, is a love story between two sort of late middle-aged gay men. And Christos has always written very explicitly about sex and drugs and relationships, and this book is no different, but it's also very tender. But he really interrogates political difference, mm-hmm, in Australian culture anyway, and certainly in this book there's a dinner party scene, you know, sort of, you know, city left-wing intellectual people's dinner party, into which his character brings his new partner, who is completely apolitical, working class, and it's this incredible sort of clash of cultures, and he's brilliant at that sort of stuff.
Excellent. Oh, I'm looking forward to that. That sounds brilliant. Yeah. Oh, amazing. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to chat with you. I will put all the links to those writers in and their books that are available worldwide in the show notes. And Stoneyard Devotional is out now. It's just, as I mentioned, I kept wanting to put the book down to run away to write. Honestly, it's just incredible what you've managed to do with that book. I just was completely sucked in. Completely.
Oh, Penny, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I love talking to you. Thank you.